come up on a tight wire.
I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Today, my guest is poet Octavio Quintanilla, whose book is called If I Go Missing. It's a collection of poems, and it's, shall we say, hot off the press. And he will also read a poem of the week. So stick around. It's going to be a great interview. Before we get started, I want to tell you about something that happened to me the other day. I was at the grocery store, and I was buying gallons of water. I drink a lot of water, so I piled several bottles of big gallons of water in my cart, and I'm pushing it down the aisle, and I go to the register. The cashier, she looks at me, and she looks at my cart, and then she looks at me again, and she kind of leans in like she's going to tell me something intimate, and she tilts her head, and she says, "Are you a preacher?" "What? I thought you might be a preacher." And I'm thinking, why would she think I'm a preacher? I think I probably look more like a male model. Okay, maybe not at my age, unless it's an ad for Viagra. But I'm thinking, why would she have thought this? You know, why would she think that I'm a preacher out of anything to guess? And as I was pushing my water through the parking lot, it occurred to me that she must have thought I was on my way to a Bible study or something and I was getting enough water for everybody. Or maybe she thought I was going to baptize a bunch of people with Aquafina. But still, she could have thought I was a counselor at an AA meeting or maybe a Boy Scout troop leader. They might feasibly need a lot of water. But she guessed I was a preacher. And then it kind of occurred to me, and this may not make sense to everyone. If you're a writer, this will make sense. Writers, we tend to think on metaphorical levels, even when we're not doing it purposely. Or to paraphrase Garcia Lorca, we understand an image and its metaphor at the same time. So water, the image of water, has metaphorical value as the Holy Spirit, as life itself, as a symbol for cleansing. Water, the image, has deep religious and spiritual connotations. And so it got me to thinking, maybe this cashier is a writer or should be a writer, and she thinks on the level of metaphor and archetype. And consciously or not, this is how writers think. We develop this way of seeing where we see an image and we see the meaning of the image at the same time. Let me give you an example. Let's say I see a man walking his dog, and I notice that the dog wants to go one way, but the man wants to go another. And then the dog kind of, you know, whimpers, but the man just pulls it by the collar, and the dog gets dragged a few inches and then finally gets on his feet and starts to catch up. Now, you can look at this on the level of metaphor and probably make predictions about that man's character, because a dog represents, among other things, affection, loyalty, unconditional love. Those of you who have ever lost a dog know what I'm talking about. Sometimes it's harder to lose a dog than a human family member. So this man's dog wants to go one way, but the man ignores it and just pulls it along the neck. He's probably a jerk. He probably does the same things in his human relationship. If you're a writer and you see that, you probably think, oh, that's a good detail for a story. Here's another one. I have a cousin who has a bulldog that he has chained to a tree in the backyard. Chained to a tree in the backyard. What is a dog? Affection. What is a dog? Loyalty. What is a dog? Unconditional love. And he has his dog chained to a tree in the backyard. You know what the dog's name is? Thug. I kid you not. So, what assumptions based on this image can you make about my cousin? You can see him, can't you? And writers can't help it. We think in metaphor. We think in archetypes, even when we don't know we're doing it. I don't know if you ever heard of the comedian Jeff Foxworthy. He's known as a redneck comedian. And he has this premise, one that made him famous. And it goes, you might be a redneck if. For example, one of his jokes go, you might be a redneck if you think loading the dishwasher means getting your wife drunk. Well, I'm going to use that premise, only I'm going to alter it a bit. And I'm going to say, you might be a writer if. So here's signs that you might be a writer. You might be a writer if, on a first date, it starts to rain, you wonder what it means to the relationship. You might be a writer if you think Obi-Wan Kenobi says to Luke, metaphors be with you. You might be a writer if you think manual labor is a Mexican poet. Oh yeah, I love Labor's poem. You might be a writer if at least a few of your books have red wine stains on them. You might be a writer if you keep collections of poetry next to your toilet. If you have a portrait of William Faulkner in your office. If you read the stories in Playboy. And you might be a writer if you don't think Murakami is a type of sushi. And, of course, finally, you might be a writer if you listen to Words on a Wire and stay tuned for poet Octavio Quintanilla. We'll be right back. Octavio Quintanilla's poems have appeared in Salamander, Rhino, Alaska Quarterly Review, The Bitter Oleander, Los Angeles Review, Border Crossing, The Texas Books in Review, and many, many more. He is author of the new collection of poems, If I Go Missing. Octavio, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you.
Well, congratulations on your first book of poems, If I Go Missing, which came out this year, 2014. Before we get to that book, which I like quite a bit, I want to know a little bit about you. Where are you right now?
Right now, I live in San Antonio. This is my second year teaching at Our Lady of the Lake University in the new MA-MFA program here that we just started. And I come from the valley, the Rio Grande Valley, by the border.
What town?
I was born in West Laco, Texas.
Wow.
However, I got my undergrad degree at UT Pan American in Edinburgh, and then I taught high school for 7 years at Harlingen High. And also after high school, I lived in San Benito, Texas for about three or four years. So I kind of lived all over the place in South Texas.
Well, the Rio Grande Valley, there's a strong tradition of Chicano writers coming out of there, poets and fiction writers.
Right, yeah.
And now you...
yeah. There's a nice literary movement in the valley right now, and of course, you know, you have Rolando Noza Smith coming out of Mercedes, and a bunch of other great writers.
My good friend Juan Ochoa lives out there. Just came out with a book. Do you know Juan?
Yes, I do. Juan Ochoa. Yeah, Marihuano. Yeah.
Yes. Not him, but the name of his book.
Of course, yeah, that's the title of his book. Yeah, but I
and Katie Hirth, the poet.
Yeah, she lives down there, and I do know her. We've had a couple of readings together.
You share a publisher.
Yes, we do. I think her first full length manuscript was published by Slough Press. You know, a small press. You know, that's been publishing since 1973.
Right. I think. Yeah. And then, of course, we can't forget that Emmy Perez is out there now.
Yeah, now she's down there, and she's an amazing poet. She's always supported my work, and now I'm glad that it's in book form. You know,
right.
We all talked about that, but she's down there. Juan Ochoa, Katie, Brian Allen Carr, Chris Carmona. There's a bunch of writers right now that are publishing and trying to create a literary culture in the valley.
Yeah, and it's quite rich. I did a reading out there last year, and I was really impressed by the literary culture. And in fact, that makes a lot of sense now, because I'm reading your book, your first book of poems called If I Go Missing.
Mm-hmm.
As I'm reading, I'm thinking, where did this guy come from? I've never heard of him before. Now it makes sense. You come from such a rich literary heritage. It must have influenced you a lot growing up there. What kind of poets did you read?
Well, as a young man, I read a lot of the French symbolist poets. But then, of course, as I educated myself, I read a lot of contemporary American poets like Mark Strand, Charles Simic, James Wright, Anne Sexton, and of course Gloria Anzaldúa. You know, a lot of her poems and the book La Frontera. In high school, you know, you read the poets that we all read, you know, Wordsworth and all those guys. But then after high school, I started exploring more, and I really got interested in poetry, and specifically the Latin American poets, that type of surrealism I really loved, like César Vallejo and Ernesto Cardenal, Jorge Luis Borges. And I think to a certain extent, all of my reading – along with all my experiences in South Texas, have made their way into my book.
Yeah, you mentioned Mark Strand. We had him on the show when his latest book came out, and had him read a poem. It's amazing to hear him read. Mm-hmm. You have a poem in your collection called The Left Hand, and it's dedicated to Mark Strand. Can you tell me what it is about Mark Strand that might have been an influence on you? Because I see, as I'm reading your book, the two names that come to mind are Mark Strand and Borges as influences. How did each one of them influence you, do you think?
I really like the way that Mark Strand uses French settings, all surrealistic language in his poems. I like how some of the poems are very abstract. And I wanted to incorporate some of that, some of those elements in my poems, but at the same time, have a narrative strand. I also love the poems of Larry Levis, for example. So one of the things that I wanted to do was how to make those two poetic approaches work. You know, have that element of surrealism and maybe even abstraction, but also grounded in narrative. You know. So both of them can mediate each other. As far as Borges, I love his fiction. I really like the strangeness of it and the surprising characters and narrators and situations in his fiction. So I wanted to some extent, also have those elements in my poems. And that's why you have a poem such as The Left Hand, which is, like you said, you know, after Mark Strand and Carlos Drummond de Andrade, who have poems about the left hand, you know, and mine is a variation of that, you know. So yeah, I'm in conversation with all those poets that I fell in love with as a student and even now, you know, mm-hmm. that I know their work. So it's a constant conversation, and I'm always trying to. I always read to learn, you know, from the poets that I admire.
Right. You know, that makes a lot of sense what you were saying, and I'm going to say it again in my own words, but it's a really important point. You were talking about how Mark Strand's language is really, it's simple. It's quite frankly very straightforward, yet it's able to go in imaginative places that are really difficult to go with such straightforward language. Usually you kind of need a more lyrical, flowery language to get into places like that. But he goes into really weird places with very sober language. And I would compare him to Kafka. You know, we think of Kafka as surreal, and probably a more accurate term would be eerreal, because the surrealism, of course, is attached to a particular genre that Kafka doesn't really fall under. But his language is so straightforward. It's very subject-verb almost, and yet it goes into the incredibly imaginative places. And now that you say that, and it's allowing me to understand your book a little bit more, because I'm reading If I Go Missing, and one of the things that I notice is that every poem in this collection is completely accessible. I'm never lost. I'm never saying, what is he trying to say? But what's really wonderful about the tension in these poems is that as accessible as it is, it also goes into imaginative landscapes that that are irreal. So I could see that influence. When you start to write a poem, what is the original impulse? Is it idea? Is it language? Is it rhythm? Is it image?
I think most of the time it changes with, I guess, the mood I'm in. But overall, when I think of a poem or when I think about writing a poem, it often starts with an image. I guess I keep it in mind and I keep working on it in my mind until slowly I build up, I build a narrative around it. And sometimes it's the other way around. You know, I start with a narrative and I want to get to that point in the poem where things change, where there's a poetic leap. And sometimes I use the image to do that. You know, I like how a metaphor or a simile works hard for you, you know, for what you're trying to say. But at the same time, I'm always aware of not to overdo it, you know. I want the images to be grounded in the whole body of the poem, you know. I just don't want them to stick out or to be just beautiful or whatever. I want them to to somehow work within the structure of the poem. But overall, you know, I'm not, you know, like many poets, I guess, you know, I'm not the type of poet that sits around and to write a poem. I'm always thinking about poetry. I see the world through the poetic lens. So, you know, like a lot of other poets, I carry a notebook with me or text myself when I think of something that I think it's clever or that I think it's interesting in terms of language. And I know that at one point I'm going to come back to that and use it in my poem. So somehow the poem slowly builds itself. And often it might start with an image, sometimes with a claim, you know, just one sentence. If you notice in the poems and if I go missing, like you said, I think you're completely right. I mean, the poems are very straightforward, very direct. There's no, you know, I try to avoid gimmicks. So I'm always asking myself, what do I want to do with this poem? What is it that I want to say? And hopefully it's not just beautiful language, but it transcends that, you know, but I'm always, always, always interested in language and words.
When we had C.D. Wright on the show, I love her book, Deep Step Come Shining. It's just an incredible, it's one long poem, but it's just, it's amazing. And certainly she's one of the living masters of American poetry today.
Right.
And when I was reading, you know, her latest book, I understood it.
Mm-hmm.
I understood. I thought, man, this is C.D. Wright, and I understand. And and when I had her on the show, I asked, this book is much more accessible than your earlier books. And
right.
I don't know if she was quite offended, but she was somewhat taken aback.
Uh-huh.
And she says, well, I certainly didn't mean to be opaque on the earlier books. And it got me thinking, a poet, our job is to be as straightforward and as clear as possible. But sometimes when you're like C.D. Wright, that clarity is so precise that it's very easy not to access it for a reader, or at least some readers. But if you do commit yourself to reading the poetry of C.D. Wright or other poets that we tend to think of as opaque, the
right.
meaning is there. But what happens a lot with young poets, and this is going to lead to a very tough question, I think, but what happens a lot with young poets is because we read writers like C.D. Wright, or we read writers who are less accessible than Mark Strand or Billy Collins or even Borges. Borges's poetry is extremely accessible, much
right.
more so than his fiction. But
right.
when we read poems that seem somewhat inaccessible, we begin to think that of that as an aesthetic, that it's our job to hide things and not to come right out and say them. And this is what happens with a lot of beginning poets.
Right.
But this is your first book, and it certainly has not happened to you. Do you find in teaching poetry that it's a challenge to get young poets just to say what they want to say as opposed to hiding it because they think it's more sophisticated?
Yeah, that's so interesting. I was just reading an interview online by T.S. Eliot, I think it was. Yeah, T.S. Eliot. And a similar question was raised by the interviewer. And Eliot, you know, this is to paraphrase, he said something about how as a young poet, there were so many things he wanted to say, and he wanted to say them so fast, and that often he obscured meaning, because he had not yet learned the language on how to say those things that he really wanted to say. So I think I went through a period of writing poems that not even I understood. I didn't know where they were going. You know, I just didn't know where they were going.
Right.
But I was so, I guess, I was so attracted to this abstraction and imagery and. And obviously, it all comes down to reading and reading more and learning from other poets. And that's something that, you know, as a professor of creative writing, that's, I think most of us who teach creative writing, we encounter those young students who come to our classes with an idea of what poetry ought to be. And often that idea is, you know, it's rooted in the idea that poems are ought to be hard or to not be understood by us, you know, by the, I guess, quote unquote, regular reader. But then that's where you bring other types of poems that they might have not encountered as they came into poetry. So they can see the difference between what they're writing and maybe more contemporary poets. And often it's I think it's useful for us, or for me in my case, when I teach, to help them phrase their influences. Why you know, one of the questions that I ask them is, why are you writing like this? Why are you reading? And most of the time when they tell you who they're reading, then you get a sense of, you know, you get reasons, or you get the answer of why they're writing that way.
Like Derek Walcott, for example, is a great poet. You get an inexperienced reader of poetry, hand them a Derek Walcott poem, they're not going to know what the heck it is, but they're going to misinterpret his precision and his kind of, frankly, his mastery of the forms, his mastery of the discourse community, his unique voice in it. They're going to mistake that for obscurity and think, well, I have to write a poem that no one can understand. But if you know how to read Derek Walcott, it is incredibly understandable. I'm talking to Octavio Quintanilla, whose book, If I Go Missing, a book of poems, is hot off the presses, I guess you can say. Let me ask you a little bit about how this book came about, its shape-wise. And you have it in three sections, If, right, and I Go, and then Missing. How did that organization come about?
To be honest with you, when I first submitted the manuscript to the publisher, to the editors, the sections didn't have titles. So the breaking down the three sections into the parts of a title was a suggestion given to me by one of the editors. And I just went along with it. And I think now I kind of like how it reads and how it flows. You know, in the original manuscript, I didn't have subtitles for the sections, you know. That just came out of a suggestion, and I liked it. I responded well to that, so I'm like, okay. So that's how the three subtitles of the sections came to be. But the overall arrangement of the poems, I mean, I think that was one of the hardest things for me to get done. You know?
Did you print them all out and put them on the floor and look at them and say, okay, what order do they need to be in?
Well, no, not necessarily. What happened with me is that I worked for about 2 years before I submitted the manuscript for publication. I had been working on it, and I would be changing. I would print them out, and you know, every time I would print out the poems, the order of the poems was different because I was always tinkering with the structure, and the way it is now. I mean, that was like at the last minute, just before I went out to, you know, my last submission to the press, I changed the order of the poems again. But one of the things that I realized is that no matter how I put the poems in terms of order, somehow the poems still spoke to each other. There was an underlying theme that held them together.
Nice.
I like that. So that kind of made me feel better about the overall narrative of the poems. And also at that point in the process, I was already sick of the poems. I was bored with the poems, so I wanted to find different ways to encounter them. And you know, that's how that manuscript, the structure came to be, you know, just messing with it.
Wow, that's very interesting. We're talking to Octavio Quintanilla, author of If I Go Missing, a collection of poems. Now, I'm going to ask you a question that is going to be really hard to answer, I think. Maybe it'll be easy to answer, but for most poets, I think it's a difficult question to answer, maybe even impossible, but I'm going to ask you to answer it anyway. If I were to ask you to name a poem in this collection that is representative of the book, representative of you as a poet, i.e. your favorite, or one of the strongest in the collection, which poem would you hand to me?
I think it would be Legacy.
Legacy. Would you do us the honor of reading that poem for our segment we call Poem of the Week?
Yes, I will.
Awesome. Legacy by Octavio Quintanilla.
Legacy. Not in this life, but in another. I had a woman, and the woman had a baby. Before breakfast, I thought of misfortune. Lawnmower stolen. Crow white with maggots. One day, cold turned clouds into small black goats. They wanted me to follow them to the town where I was born. I licked their scent, licked the wool of their being. That night, I carried water by its hips. I tell my son what my father told me. In your mouth, this milk will feel as warm as a hand inside a cow's vagina. He doesn't laugh, but looks into me like a deer gazing into the eye that will bring peace.
Legacy, a poem by Octavio Quintanilla in his new book, If I Go Missing. One day, cold turned clouds into small black goats. That is a beautiful line. Let me ask you about this poem. Was this a painful poem to write?
Yeah, I guess you can say that. It's a poem that I think, you know, when you ask me that question, that's a really interesting question. And because I guess I never really think about my poems. It's, you know, this is my first book, Daniel, and I'm just learning how to articulate ideas about my own book.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about, you know, the poems of other poets, you know, the books of other poets, but I'm slowly learning how to talk about my own poems. And when you asked me that question, this is the first poem that came to my mind, Legacy.
Right.
One of the poems that I've been incorporating in my readings. And I think it's one of those poems that, I don't know, originates in my experience living in Mexico. I lived in Mexico for the first 9 years of my life. I was born here in Texas, but right after, you know, I think I was probably one, my parents moved back to Mexico. So I went to Mexican schools. I lived down there for 9 years. So somehow I think this poem, you know, it's about memory. It's about somehow something that part of who I am still goes back to that experience. And I think a lot of the poems here are infused by my experience in Mexico, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, this poem was hard to write, but at the same time, I don't know, it's close to my heart.
Well, vale la pena, that's what I got to say. Thank you so much for joining us, Octavio Quintanilla, on Words on a Wire.
Thank you, Daniel. Thank you all.
I'm Daniel Chacon. Thank you for joining me for this fantastic edition of Words on a Wire with poet Octavio Quintanilla. And when I was coming up with that list of you might be a writer if, I called a couple of friends, Nancy Lechuga, who you know very well. She's been on this show many times, and Moses Ayub, and they helped me come up with some of those. And I want to put a call out. If you have a you might be a writer if joke, send it to me at danchacon@utep.edu. And if it's funny, I'll read it on the air. Join me every week for another edition of Words on a Wire. Don't forget, you know you're a writer if you really believe the next book you read may save your life.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on a tight rope. One side's hate and one is hope.